blockade.
People are seen browsing the merchandise lining the streets and sidewalks of Gaza and hardly buying anything. They shop for long hours to try and find affordable gifts for their families.
During the holidays before the blockade, I used to buy a lot of clothes and gifts for my children, but nowadays I just buy them a few things. I have been coming to the market for 3 days now, trying to find something that I can afford.
According to UN figures, some 80% of Gazans depend on humanitarian aid to survive. Experts say the Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has devastated Gaza's economy and worsened the living conditions.
The Israeli blockade has been in place for a very long time and is the main reason for the weak purchasing power during Eid al-Adha. The majority of people in Gaza have a limited income, and more than 60% of the population suffers from poverty and unemployment. People are having a very hard time during the holidays, and they can hardly afford to put food on the table.
All happy occasions in this impoverished territory have been marred by the blockade and Israeli atrocities in recent years.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are preparing themselves for Eid al-Adha holiday, despite the dire straits facing them due to the Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Taxi drivers have staged a nationwide strike against the government's plan to deregulate the sector. The industrial action was called by a string of unions representing cab drivers in opposition to Article 10 of a competition bill linked to the reforms the EU requires in exchange for the funding of Italy's post-COVID National Recovery and Resilience Fund. Unionists say that the regulation will open cab drivers up to unfair competition from web-based ride-sharing services.
A law that regulates our sector was already approved 3 years ago, and the EU doesn't require further amendments. Taxi fares are presently regulated by local authorities. Prices would go ballistic if we let the privates take over. A deregulation would favour multinationals over independent drivers. Full stop.
On Monday, a protest called by unionists in Rome's central quarters led to disruption to traffic and buses in the Italian capital. The demonstration ended up in clashes with police. On Tuesday, tens of cab drivers gathered at Rome's municipality, asking local authorities to take their side. Protests were also held in Milan and other Italian cities.
Like taxi drivers across the European Union, Italy's licensed cabbies have been protesting ever since private hired services such as Uber arrived on the scene in 2014. An endless series of strikes and protests against the liberalization of the sector have been staged over the years.
This government works for the almighty dollar, that's it. We are in the midst of an unprecedented economic crisis, and what does the executive do? It gives multinationals more privileges. What about us, the people?
Tension within the broad coalition supporting Prime Minister Mario Draghi's government was high over the competition bill until not long ago. However, a split in the once anti-establishment five-star movement, with Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio embracing Draghi's more pro-market views, seems to have calmed down the churning waters of Italian politics. Max Civili, Rome.
Over a million Muslims converged on the Arafat desert in Saudi Arabia as the biggest Hajj pilgrimage since the beginning of the pandemic is nearing its climax. Arafat signifies the high point of the Hajj pilgrimage, where the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, delivered his final sermon, calling for equality and unity among Muslims.
Actually, Hajj season is of supreme importance because they have been all brought together for the unity of the Islamic Ummah. God could tell everybody to stay in their own home country and do the prayer, say the prayer, and do Hajj rituals. But it wasn't do so because God wanted to bring all the Islamic Ummah together so that they could get to know each other and communicate with one another. This is the importance of the unity of Hajj.
The pilgrims set out for Arafat before dawn and spent the night in deep contemplation. They also gathered on the Mountain of Mercy, offering prayers of repentance. Muslims believe prayers in Arafat are the best opportunity for salvation and spiritual renewal.
Arafat is a very sacred and holy place because all Muslims from around the globe have to attend here and get together. There are some rituals which are usually done, one of which is saying Arafat Dua, which was actually initiated by Imam Hussein, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him. The other importance of this, let's say, land, this holy land, is that Imam al-Zaman, Imam Mahdi Ajalallah Ta'ala Farajo Sharif, is also here. The only problem is that the people here don't recognize who he is, though he is doing the rituals with the Islamic Ummah.
Staying in Arafat is one of the main parts of Hajj. The stay of pilgrims is said to lead to forgiveness of their sins.
After staying in Arafat until nightfall, pilgrims will march or take a bus to the desert of Muzdalifah to collect pebbles to carry out the symbolic stoning of the devil later in Mina on Saturday. Mahdi Abbasian, Arafat Desert.
It is clearly now the will of the Parliamentary Conservative Party that there should be a new leader of that party and therefore a new Prime Minister.
Boris Johnson led his party to a landslide victory in the 2019 election. Little did he know he wouldn't even see through his first term, undone by multiple scandals and by flaws in his character that critics say made him unfit for office. The coronavirus pandemic offered Boris Johnson a perfect cocktail of crises and chaos that shifted attention from other problems.
Boris Johnson promised to get Brexit done, but nearly 2 years on, his country is still mired in a dispute with the European Union. The IMF says the UK will have the slowest economic growth of the G7 nations next year. Add to that the rising cost of living and also the faltering health and education systems.
Success with the vaccine program helped mitigate the frustration over Johnson's dithering and delays in following scientific advice that contributed to one of the highest death tolls in the developed world and almost took his life. His leadership style and character flaws always acted as ammunition for his critics and the opposition.
He's inflicted lies, fraud, and chaos in the country. And, you know, we're stuck with a government which isn't functioning in the middle of a cost of living crisis.
Then came the Partygate scandal. The Conservative Party was now in crisis. Johnson received wide support for his backing of the Ukrainian government in the ongoing military conflict in the country. But the Partygate scandal refused to go away. He received a police fine for attending one of multiple lockdown-breaching parties in Downing Street, becoming the first sitting British Prime Minister to have broken the law.
Mr. Speaker, I want to apologize.
Eventually, 148 of his own MPs, 40% of the parliamentary party, turned against him in a vote of no confidence. He survived it and staggered on. And then it emerged he had known about this man, Chris Pincher's, sexual misconduct and appointed him to a powerful position still. Within days, the man, nicknamed the Great Political Survivor, was forced to throw in the towel. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Tehran, the capital of Iran, and now a destination for investors. Tehran Investment Summit brought together businesses, mayors, and urban development officials from Iran and the world to explore areas of investment in Tehran.
It's so important for us to participate in here, and we consider as a not only for a relationship between two cities, it's in the, including for the relationship between two countries.
2 years ago, the Iranian and Nicaraguan capitals, Tehran and Managua, signed an MOU that named them as sister cities. Now, with the Tehran Investment Summit, there is a chance for Managua to further cooperate with Tehran in launching urban development projects.
210 projects covering waste management, transport, and tourism, among others, will be introduced to investors in the two-day conference. The projects total roughly $71 billion. Tehran municipality says if those projects are accomplished, they will revolutionize the Iranian capital.
This is the start of a turning point in Tehran's development. This conference was inaugurated today, but it has no closing ceremony. The exhibition section of the event will continue to run permanently to highlight any area that needs investment. This will transform Tehran's future.
Being among the busiest cities means that Tehran is inevitably among the most polluted places in the world. Municipal authorities say they also welcome any investment in controlling air pollution in Tehran.
Eliminating air pollution and traffic congestions are among the major challenges in Tehran, which can be solved permanently through the promotion of clean transportation. I'm certain that many investors would love to invest in this area.
Attracting foreign investment has long been a challenge for Iran as a result of U.S. sanctions that restrict global banking transactions with Iran.
I would not say that sanctions will not affect foreign investment, but we are focusing on the private sector, which acts separately from governments. Meanwhile, the Central Bank of Iran has also promised to support foreign investors should they take part in Tehran's development projects.
Life in the Iranian capital is a mixed experience of modernity and antiquity, as it's home to both skyscrapers and historic buildings, together making it a hot tourist target. But tourism is only one of the countless capacities for investment in Tehran, as it's home to some 15 million residents, and with a large population comes a wide array of interests and businesses.
As the capital of Iran, Tehran has numerous opportunities for investors, from tourism to transport and pollution control projects. Many of those projects have so far been running based on citizen participation or tax revenues. Now, Tehran municipality says with its approach shifting toward investment, the development of the metropolis is expected to accelerate. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing him. Terence fall low in awe of him. Faces are humbled in fear of him. And everything mighty yields to his mightiness. So to thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may his blessings be upon his messenger endlessly, and his salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need, which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
Love him or hate him, Boris Johnson, the UK Prime Minister, has resigned. Scandal after scandal, he survived the knockout punches, but the mass resignations were just too many, practically leaving him without a cabinet to run the country. The drama may not be over, since there are still those who want him to leave power immediately and not stay on until October, when a leadership race will determine who will be the next Prime Minister. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at Johnson's legacy, how he improved or hurt the UK, and what guarantees there are that the next UK Prime Minister or his cabinet or her cabinet will be any better. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Professor of Economics and political commentator Rodney Shakespeare joins us from London. Also joining us, journalist and commentator James Tweedy, who joins us from Plymouth in the UK.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. What a 48 hours it has been, Rodney Shakespeare. Let me first start with you. And looking at the British Prime Minister resignation, of course, the rebellion that came from the Conservatives, unhappy with the scandals, as we understand, surrounding his premiership. Do you think that this was just all about the scandals, or perhaps somebody had an eye on his post or his position, and maybe something went on in that respect, which amounted to all these resignations, which we understand were over 60 at this point?
It's much worse than the immediate scandals, like the cost of the wallpaper in the Downing Street flat, like not telling the truth about what he knew about someone he appointed to a government post, about the sad situation in which there were parties when other people could not be with their dying relatives. Behind this are two great big things in which was catching the Conservatives and which is going to catch Labour and the Liberals, the whole political establishment. The first is, and you can go back, say, to 2008, is that certain malfunctions in the economy not understood, and their attempts to overcome them meant that they were pumping money and not addressing the problems. And the inflation was rising before the business in Ukraine. That is going on and has been accentuated by Ukraine, and none of them have an answer. They try and raise interest rates, they will collapse the economy. Now, the second thing going on, and they're all complicit in this, it's gone on for 25 years. It's, say, 1997, when, breaking an agreement, of course, the West started to expand NATO to the east. Russia wasn't strong enough to do anything. But the purpose of moving thousands of kilometers to the east was to put hypersonic nuclear missiles right up against Russia. And of course, Russia is never allowed to have hypersonic nuclear missiles right against the USA. You then come to 2014, when there was a fascist coup. And I'll tell you what they're not telling you. The coup overthrew a democratically elected president and put into power fascist Ukrainian-speaking Ukrainians whose policy was and is to kill Russian-speaking Ukrainians. Now, the whole of the British political establishment is committed to that fascist regime, which, by the way, has got rid of all the political parties in Ukraine. Don't talk to me about democracy there. Mm-hmm. The whole of the political establishment in the UK is committed to an understanding of economics and finance to which they have no solution. I got my energy bills today. I won't tell you. They were eye-watering. And at the same time, they are locked in like a train which cannot slow down into this Ukrainian policy, which they are making worse. And even today, the Americans are going to put more sanctions on Iran to stop Iranian oil coming into the market. They're locked into disaster. It goes through all the political parties in the UK. And I'm afraid the whole situation is going to get worse.
Well, that's not very promising, is it? We were going to get into the economic side of this whole thing a little bit later on, which I'm going to leave for a little bit later on so I can get an immediate reaction from you, if I may, James Tweedy, about just the whole affair here of what has transpired. I mean, things really in UK politics, no one would have really thought that this would happen in the course of the past 24, 48 hours in the way that it did. Looking at some of the reactions, Nicola Sturgeon is what I'd like to ask from you, the first minister of the first Scottish minister. She said it is just an unsustainable proposition to say that he's going to continue to inhabit number 10. I'm not sure anybody could look at Boris Johnson and conclude that he is capable of genuinely behaving as a caretaker prime minister. Why do you think there's such a push? It's not just her saying that. Why do you think this approach towards Johnson, like what we're seeing from Nicola Sturgeon?
It's like Mr. Shakespeare said, it's about the economic crisis. It's not really about one of his MPs going to a private members club with other Tory MPs and other Tory party members and, getting drunk and touching two of them up. That's not even Johnson's fault that the man behaved like that. It's because of the country's in crisis. You've got the crisis of rampant inflation, inflation heading towards 11% soon, because of the sanctions that it's all self-inflicted. It's because of the sanctions that we've put on Russia and the oil and gas embargo we've put on Russia. And things like, household utilities, household gas and electricity, and filling up your car, the prices of those things are doubling. This is the real problem. This is what's making the government unpopular. But like Mr. Shakespeare said, there's nobody who wants to change that. Nicola Sturgeon, a couple of months ago, called for a no-fly zone over the Ukraine, a NATO-imposed no-fly zone. Boris Johnson said that would lead to World War III. So Nicola Sturgeon is not a serious person. Her whole focus is on trying to rerun the independence referendum that she failed to win, or her party failed to win, back in 2014, and nobody wants that. And this is the thing. So this leads into one of the reasons why Johnson is probably going to be able to stay on, because his party, what happened to him was normal in the Conservative Party. Exactly the same thing happened to Theresa May. That's why Boris Johnson became leader and prime minister. The same thing happened to Margaret Thatcher. They all survived a no confidence vote by the backbenchers. But then, things got worse, the crisis got worse, and people came to have a quiet word with them, and they resigned. Some ministers resigned and spoke out against them. That happened to Thatcher. But now what? Now where are they going? Well, he's staying on. Now people say it's untenable or it's weird. Well, okay, someone's got to be prime minister until the new one is elected, which is also normal. It's not normal to change prime ministers like that in Britain. The alternative, the only alternative, the only way they've got to get rid of him, if they don't like it, is to have a parliamentary no confidence vote, which means an immediate, in the government, not in him, but in the government, which means an immediate snap general election. And if that happens, firstly, as things stand with the party's popularity, a lot of those MPs, those Conservative MPs, would lose their seats and their lucrative jobs in that election. And then you would end up probably, most likely, a hung parliament with Labour, maybe as the largest party, forming a coalition with the Liberal Democrats and the Scottish National Party. And the SNP would demand another referendum, and in fact they'll demand one every parliament or every couple of years even until Scottish people get bored of it and vote to leave the UK, possibly, or just get rid of, you know, stop voting for the Scottish National Party, perhaps.
Okay.
But that's probably a non-starter. And, you know, again, as Mr. Shakespeare said, it's very hard to see any of the potential candidates, because two of the favourites are Ben Wallace, the Defence Secretary, and Liz Truss, the Foreign Secretary, who are both the leading proponents of the war, even more as much as Johnson, or more so, the war in Ukraine, or back in Ukraine in its war against Russia. And they're not going to change policy. They're not going to change the policy that's causing the basic problem of inflation.
Sure. Well, I mean, where can I start with this whole affair, Rodney Shakespeare, of the unstable situation that the government is facing? I mean, can it be called a government at this point? I mean, we're looking at October being the date that there's going to be a passover from the caretaker PM to the whoever is going to get picked. But what's going to happen until then? I mean, we know the state of affairs in the UK, as you just said, the cost of energy is so high. Your electric bill, you can't even mention it because it brought tears to your eyes or made your eyes water. I mean, how is this government going to even function, especially given the fact you got 60 ministers who have resigned, even though there's been a new cabinet that's already put in place from what we understand?
James referred to a competence motion, and he also said or indicated that that won't happen because those Conservative MPs will lose their seats. There's another possibility. The Prime Minister is the Queen's Prime Minister, and it is conceivable that a quiet word would suggest to Boris that he should go. But that the Queen must have a Prime Minister. And I believe that Theresa May, I think, is indicating that she's not willing. So the chances are that Boris will stay as Prime Minister until the Conservatives get themselves organised. As regards who will come through, the trouble is you've got a whole batch of second-rate candidates. And just do a thought experiment. Who can you think of who could have a raft of new policy to solve the problems, who could unite the Conservative Party, and who could appeal to the whole of the country, and who is able to rethink major policy, e.g., on sanctions on Ukraine, and you can't think of anyone. So there's the problem for the Conservative Party. This is going to drag on. The situation is going to get worse. British politics is going to go into a sort of melting point as these big issues, as James is indicating, as these big issues start to play and have more obvious effect.
Well, since we've talked about the Ukraine conflict, I have to ask you, James Tweedy, about what the Russian ambassador to the UK has said. And he said that Britain's Boris Johnson's fall was just a reward for what he said, a belligerent anti-Russian policy of support for Ukraine, while ignoring the economic needs of the British people, that he concentrated too much on the geopolitical situation on Ukraine. Do you think he had a point?
Yeah, that's justifiable. That's what both of us have been saying so far. Others have said, some bloggers like Larry Johnson, who's an American conservative but anti-war blogger, Andrei Martyanov, who's a Russian who lives and works in the US, that this is just going to be the start. Johnson isn't going to be the first prime minister or president to go because of this. You know, over in the States, Joe Biden is facing defeat in the midterm elections in November, and then his future starts to look uncertain. People can see that he's not compos mentis. You know, he's losing his marbles. You know, in France, Emmanuel Macron, the president, has lost his governing majority in Parliament, and the parties that picked up seats were the national, what they call it, the National Rally now, it used to be the National Front, and a coalition of left-wing parties led by Jean-Luc Mélenchon. And both of those are against the war and against, and essentially against NATO membership, and so on. And it will, you know, and there are other governments. The Dutch government is very vulnerable because they've decided to bankrupt, you know, to bankrupt the farming industry in their country for some, on some pretext of ecological reasons, and the farmers have, you know, have blocked all the motorways, and you can't get food on the, into the supermarkets, and that's spreading to Belgium now. So all these governments are going to start coming down because, you know, the whole of Europe is in crisis, you see. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the ambassador is justified in that, and it's not going to, you know, this is just the beginning.
Sure. What is this committee that's going to, at this point, Rodney Shakespeare, perhaps rule on the fact that it's not going to take, it shouldn't take 1 year for a, I guess, a vote of confidence to take place, and that's going to get reduced. I mean, is that the way that, isn't that another way of saying that there won't be enough time for a person who comes into a position to be able to perform, and therefore, with the shortened length of time, that the other party members may say, it's time for this person to go, let's bring on the next person, in a sense. Is that where UK politics is headed to?
Well, on the surface it is, but what is coming is the winter and further increased prices, and particularly out of control energy prices. And James is referring to political events right the way around the world. And they all seem to be slightly different. But in fact, the big factors that we've discussed are all playing there. So in British politics, you're going to have to look at the situation, maybe, shall we say, at the beginning of winter. I mean, look at what's going to happen in Germany at the beginning of winter. I mean, the EU is crashing its own economies. Germany, you know, the great powerhouse, is going to, it's industry is going to be smashed at the beginning of winter, and ordinary people are going to have a tough time as well. So these are the big things, and there's no answer to it. I don't want you to think in terms of, oh, British politics will carry on, we'll just have another prime minister and they'll have majority of 80. The situation is capable and I think likely to get very sharply worse, inflation wise heating-wise, politics in different countries, they're all starting to attack and start to put pressure on their governments. All this is going to get worse September, October, November.
What type of monetary policies, what type of economic direction can the UK then take, given the state that it is in right now, James Tweedy, moving forward until you get the new prime minister into his post, who then is going to perhaps try to see what direction it's going to go with the UK, because at this point, this government is not going to make those major decisions as relayed by the Prime Minister and other members.
No, I mean, Johnson has said that he's not going to make any big policy changes because he's going, you know, out of deference to whoever takes over from him, big policy changes. Okay. What needs to happen is that the UK needs to drop its oil and gas embargoes on Russia, and needs to negotiate with Russia and then start buying oil and gas as much as they can get. It would need to persuade its European neighbors to do the same. The USA is already cheating on its own sanctions. It's still importing oil from Russia, but, you know, and leaving Europe to, you know, leaving their tanks to run dry, basically. So they've got to persuade the rest of the European Union and NATO countries to do the same. So, you know, just get the market so that there isn't, an unusually high demand in the market elsewhere, things like that. And it's got to negotiate with Russia and you know, give them back all the assets that they seized and things like that in return for things. And it's going to mean dropping support for Ukraine, and of course they need to persuade, change course completely, make a U-turn and persuade Volodymyr Zelensky to make a peace deal with the Russians, with the Russian government. And then, of course, what's been going on in the last couple of years? Because, this is one of the things that meant that Boris Johnson's got very little to show for his 3 years as prime minister, is that we had the COVID pandemic. And people were told to stay at home and not work, but they were paid, 80% of their wages or whatever were paid by the government while they were doing that. So people had money to spend, but things weren't being produced in the same quantity as before. Work wasn't getting done. And prices of everything shot up. And people were taking that money and spending. They couldn't go on holiday, so they were spending it on home improvements. And, you couldn't find a builder or a decorator. They all had like 2 year waiting lists, and they couldn't find enough materials. They couldn't find cement. I had some guy working on my roof. I managed to get him round, luckily, but he had a hard time getting the cement. And it's great. You need to get more productive industries going. There needs to be production, real economy. That's Russia's advantage. Real economy.
Right.
It has a load. It is the biggest producer of several commodities that every country needs, and every industry. Every industry needs. This is the sort of thing Britain needs to be doing, and it needs to be buying stuff in and getting the supply way higher than demand and bringing those prices down.
Let me jump in since we're just out of time practically here and give Rodney Shakespeare the final question. Under a minute, if you can, Rodney Shakespeare. What do you think about the way that the UK is going to carry on with the EU in terms of whoever that's going to come in? Will it reduce these post-Brexit tensions when it comes to the way that the UK is going to interact with the EU?
No, the tensions are going to get worse. The situation over the UK breaking the agreement, that's going Northern Ireland. The Northern Ireland unionists have been shoved under a bus. That situation is going to get worse. Yes, you've got to get rid of those sanctions, but the EU are more set on increasing the sanctions and doing preposterous things, like thinking that you can cut the price of the oil that you buy from Russia. And these are nonsense things. The whole thing is locked into going worse. And I'm going to make a rule for you, which is quite simple. Anything the Conservatives do now and in the near future will make the situation worse.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Thank you very much for that. Rodney Shakespeare, professor of economics and political commentator from London, and also James Tweedy, thank you, from Plymouth in the UK, journalist and commentator. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tavlay and the team, this is goodbye until next time.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Palestinian digital rights experts have long decried the increasing censorship of Palestinian content online. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jessica Waxbaum, journalist. This article is published under the heading Censoring Palestine. Swarms of Israeli regime bots are crippling pro-Palestinian Twitter accounts. Here's more. On April 29th, Ines Abdulrazak woke up to 80 new Twitter followers. These accounts were following the exact same people that were tweeting about Palestine, but from France or Francophone accounts that work on Palestine, Razek said, for her new followers. The advocacy director of RABIT, the Palestine Institute for Public Diplomacy's digital platform, became wary of the issue after Abir Khateb, a grants manager at Open Society Foundations, reported mass fallings as well. Razek told Min Press News that she began individually reporting each account as fake, but kept her own account open, lest she let the alleged bots win. But after a few days, Razek made her profile private. At the peak of the mass falling, Razek had accumulated 400 fake followers. From the end of April through the first few weeks of May, more than 40 pro-Palestine Twitter accounts reported mass fallings. Digital rights experts say acquiring huge amounts of fake followers triggers Twitter's algorithm and can lead to the tech giant suspending an account, effectively censoring users by forcing them to make their accounts private. These accounts included those belonging to human rights, activist organizations, Adala, Combatants for Peace, Breaking the Silence, and Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights. They also included news publications and journalists like the Palestine Chronicle, Ali Abu Nima and Hend Al-Iryani, and politicians such as Hossam Zumlot, the Palestinian ambassador to the UK. Twitter did not respond to Min Press inquiries on the source of suspicious accounts. Dr. Mark Owen Jones, an assistant professor at Hamad Ben Khalifa University, conducted an analysis that found more than 1,150 fake accounts. Twitter deleted approximately 1,090 of these accounts, according to Jones. His analysis determined that the average account creation time was one of the three per minute, suggesting these accounts were created using an automated process. The profiles were in various languages, including French, Spanish, English, and German, but usually had Arabic bias. They often had strange names like Nobel Betty Thomas and zero followers. They had clearly made up names. Sarah Lee Whitson, who also experienced a large influx of new followers, told Min Press. The vast majority of them had Israeli names and Israeli addresses. Some of them had made up Arab names, which were mangled. It's clear that they are using stolen images of people. In response to the bulk following, software developer Daniel Isterman created a free script to automatically report and block hundreds of these bots for users. Isterman said the spamming problem has a censorship effect by forcing users to make their accounts private. This means they won't be able to distribute their messages widely as they would normally, Isterman told Min Press News. Another area of particular concern is how a flood of fake followers may cause Twitter to shut down an account. When you see such a dramatic increase in followers, it's usually somebody manipulating the system for commercial gain, Isterman said, adding so that could trigger Twitter to automatically flag that as suspicious activity and suspend the activist account. Using Twitter to target human rights defenders and journalists isn't unusual. In 2017, journalist Lona Craig and others who report on Yemen were spammed with thousands of fake followers. Many speculated the culprits were state entities belonging to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. The reason behind this particular mass following campaign remains unknown. Jones hypothesized it's acting as a form of social media suppression, writing on Twitter. Some suggest it's a means to degrade the algorithmic quality of a Twitter account so that it possibly gets suspended. Some suggest it's others trying to boost popularity of an account. When it's unsolicited, as in this case, I tend to think it's more of a targeting operation. I'm naturally cynical, but most people who get a sudden influx of fake followers feel unnerved and uncomfortable. If that fact is widely known, it functions as a tool of surveillance and potentially intimidation. That is, you are being watched. It also makes many people mute their accounts for a bit, which has a censorship effect. Razek Whitson and others told Mint Press News that the flood of fake followers appears to be diminishing for them. However, a new operation has emerged. In the past week, Jones found around 2,800 fake accounts following pro-Palestinian and anti-Zionist accounts who have recently been tweeting on the killing of Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Akleh by the Zionist regime. This network is likely the same as one found at the end of April, although now it is active, Jones wrote on Twitter. The accounts have been 0 to 20 followers, with the majority of bias written in English and simply stating the account location, which is the occupied territories. Most accounts don't have a banner picture, and the profile pictures have reportedly been swiped from real people. According to Jones, the accounts have begun liking and retweeting posts without any real partisan regularity. They like both pro- and anti-Palestinian subject matter and follow both pro-Zionist and pro-Palestinian accounts, but appear to target the pro-Palestinian side more. Accounts targeted include the Jerusalem Post, activist organization Jewish Voice for Peace, the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement, Israeli journalist Ilan Papp, and former Palestinian Liberation Organization Executive Committee member Dr. Hanan Ashrawi. Again, the reason for the bulk followers remains unclear. Those who get followed understandably find it intimidating, as if a form of surveillance, to a technique to try and degrade the quality of an account with low-quality follows, Jones wrote on Twitter. The fact remains these are clearly fake accounts and ruin the experience of Twitter. Palestinian digital rights experts have long decried the increasing censorship of Palestinian content online. During the Zionist regime's assault on Gaza and upticks in Israeli regime attacks at Al-Aqsa compound and in Sheikh Jarrah in May 2021, Palestinian activists reported social media companies were removing their content on the Israeli regime violence and ethnic cleansing for violating community guidelines. The social media censorship didn't stop when tensions died down over the summer, though. Last month, social media users in Jordan said their posts related to Israeli regime violence at Al-Aqsa were taken down and their accounts blocked. Additionally, accounts belonging to Palestinian news publications covering the violence in East Al-Quds and at Al-Aqsa were deactivated by Facebook. In their recent monthly report on social media violations, Palestinian NGO Sadaq Social stated the deletion of Palestinian content is in line with and in response to Israeli requests to tighten the screws on Palestinians and their media. Razek suggested the swarm of fake followers on Twitter may be an extension of Instagram's shadow banning. While the identities behind the fake followers haven't been revealed, many have pointed to the fabricated regime of Israel. The regime of Israel targeting of Palestinian digital content is well documented. According to Hamla, the Arab Center for the Advancement of Social Media, the Israeli regime Ministry of Justice Cyber Unit sends content removal requests aimed at Palestinian content to social media companies such as Facebook, Google, and YouTube. The Justice Ministry has boasted these corporations comply with 95% of the request, and the Zionist regime organizations and NGOs also encourage their citizens to flag Palestinian content for removal. Tech billionaire Elon Musk's pending purchase of Twitter came with a promise of securing free speech on the digital platform.
Free speech is the bedrock of a functioning democracy, and Twitter is the digital town square where matters vital to the future of humanity are debated, the self-declared free speech advocate said in a statement about his Twitter deal. While digital rights experts like Jones are wary of Musk's potential Twitter takeover, Whitson, who has experienced targeted attacks, harassment, and censorship threats for decades for speaking out against the Zionist regime's abuses, views this buyout positively. Whitson doesn't agree the bots are a form of censorship, but she does see them as an assault on free speech. She said it's a form of targeted harassment and bullying. It's a targeted attack on people who are speaking freely, including journalists and human rights activists.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.